Welcome to Partnering Leadership, conversations with leading influencers in the greater Washington, D.C. region and global thought leaders, helping you align better with your purpose, grow professionally with meaning, and have a greater impact. For additional leadership insights and bonus content, visit us at partneringleadership.com. Now here's your host, Mahan Tavakoli.
Welcome to Partnering Leadership. I'm really excited this week to be welcoming Ram Charan. Ram is a world-renowned business consultant, author of over 30 leadership books, and he has consulted with some of the top global firms, including Toyota and Bank of America, this over the past 40 years, since he was also a professor at Harvard Business School and Northwestern University. Now, I use Ron's insights in many of my conversations with business leaders and often find myself quoting him, whether it was back when I was leading strategy for Dale Carnegie Training internationally or now when having conversations with clients. So I really enjoyed the conversation with Ram. I'm sure you will too. And I absolutely love hearing from you. Keep your comments coming. Mahan@mahantavakoli.com. There's also a microphone icon on partneringleadership.com. Love getting those voice messages. Don't forget to follow the podcast. That way, you will ensure that you will be first to be notified of new releases on Tuesdays with magnificent changemakers from the greater Washington, D.C. region, and on Thursdays with global thought leaders like Ram. Now, here is my conversation with Professor Ram Charan. Professor Ram Charan, welcome to Partnering Leadership. I am absolutely honored and thrilled to have you in this conversation with me.
Thank you. I'm very honored. I look forward to it. You absolutely inspire people, give them best advice you can give. That's a huge contribution to the community.
Thank you, Ram. And for 20 plus years, you have inspired me. And for a period of time, I was on a senior team and leading strategy globally for Dale Carnegie Training. And I don't think I quoted anyone as often as I quoted Ram Charan in our senior leadership team meetings and our strategic planning meetings. So I feel like I not only know a lot about your work, but have benefited, and the organizations and clients I've worked with have also benefited. You've written over 30 books and started advising back in 1964. So I can't wait to get to your most recent book, but I also know your upbringing had a significant impact on you growing up in Uttar Pradesh in India. How did that upbringing and that initial shoe store, Ram, have an impact on your business thinking?
Mahan, the largest population of business people in the world is the street vendor. This single person business, it uses exactly the same terminology, whether you are in Russian, Chinese, American, Indian, and they make the same decisions at very micro scale. The second largest population of business people is the corner store, kirana store, shoe store, cloth store. I was in the shoe store. At the age of 10, I began to work at the shop. We measured daily sales. We measured gross margin daily. We priced daily. We cut price when shoes don't sell. We went to buy shoes every week because we didn't have enough cash to buy for the whole month. They are exactly the same thing. What is different for an Amazon is the scale, is the scope, is the use of technology. What we did in our shop, maybe we had 100 customers. Now, Amazon has more than 100 million customers. You need technology. You need sophistication. But he does the same thing. What's the sales? What's the gross margin? What are the inventories? What is the cash at the end of the day? Same exact terminology. So I learned the fundamentals. And then over time, I grew my scale that I can cut through just about any business. All businesses have to succumb to it. So many people are leaders, but they're not business people. There are many business people who are not leaders.
So Ram, how do you define being a business person as opposed to being a leader? And those are two elements that you think are essential in leading today's organizations.
The business side first, Mahan. The business side is know your customer. We did. I knew my name and the size of the feet. And know how to make money, but continue to make money. A leader of military. I had a situation of a very big railroad when they asked me to assess a very, very, very high level military person to be CEO, a strategic air command. Wonderful, great leader. He knew military side of it. He was not a business acumen. So if you look at the history of generals in America who became CEOs, the ratio of those becoming CEO successfully is not high. Now, many of the people got out of the defense services early at the age of 30, 32. They went to Wharton, Harvard, Stanford, very disciplined, very good. If you look into their careers in their early days, they work on a shoe store. They work on a discount store. They had a business acumen and they succeeded. One of the CEOs of Pepsi came from there. But the population is very small. So just like most businessmen will not make a good leader of a nation, but any CEO of any company must have a business savvy. It is not going to be implanted when you are the CEO. It may be cultivated when you are 10 years of age, 15 years of age, 20 years of age. But by the time you become president, it's too late. So they will end up having some good Secretary of Treasury. But they still have to work at it.
They do. And in your most recent book, Ram, Rethinking Competitive Advantage, you also keep emphasizing that no competitive advantage is ironclad. It must be earned on a daily basis. It reminds me of Andy Grove that also said only the paranoid survive, or Jeff Bezos's day one. You also worked pretty closely with Jack Welch and his approach to it. So what is it about organizations and leaders that are able to maintain their competitive advantage by earning it on a daily basis?
Mahan, this is the real excellent question of the day. So I had the honor of working with Andy Grove, the three geniuses. I was commissioned on a national basis to coach those three, 1978. And Andy was totally correct. And so was Welch. The key was that we academics say sustainable competitive advantage. That word came from the economics literature. A professor, Richard K. from Harvard University, did this study. Fantastic, fantastic academic person. Michael Porter picked it up and said sustainable. Sustainable implies you got an advantage, put it on autopilot. No more. Technology change, competition change, barriers are out. And so you have to earn every day. People who earn every day are the sustainable competitive advantage. So in one of my co-authored books going to come in fall called TSR, Talent, Strategy, and Risk. So Jeff Bezos taught me that if you do right talent, right strategy, right risk at the right time, your numbers will come. Talent, right talent, relevant talent, earning every day the preference of the customer is a sustainable competitive advantage. And that means innovation. That means productivity. That means figuring it out what the consumer will want. Because today, the internet has enabled people to take charge what the consumer will want. Consumers driving the behavior of the companies. So sustainable competitive advantage, and you will see in my book, we don't have the word sustainable. It is, you got to earn every day. You got to be paranoid because upbringing new startup can do that. Here, for roughly 9 years, Amazon kept AWS secret. It came out. Guess who's taking the market share? And that is Microsoft. They figured that out. Now they're expanding the market also. So it's okay. Both can really win and not a zero-sum game. But the fact is the two are different and the algorithms are 95% commoditized. They are available at variable cost. So a high school student can enter something if he has an idea, and then you can go to a spec, get it public, raise money. If it is really a big idea, it will be exposed to Masa-san in Japan and your luck is changed. Peter Thiel did that. He already had one company, and these three guys went to see him with the opposite viewpoint. During the presentation, they recognized that it is killing his own company. Now, he had the wisdom to say, I need both of you, and both of you can do a great job, which, yeah, this is what we have this right.
Ram, since you guide and coach so many of these executives and CEOs, obviously the Steve Jobses of the world, the Jeff Bezos of the world are brilliant and have that observation abilities. How do the best leaders enable more people in their organizations to develop those capabilities?
Great question. Number one, I want you to know I've worked with some of these people. If you measure their IQ, they are not the most brilliant. They're not. I can tell you that firsthand. And I've seen the richest ones, worked with them, seen them. The brilliance mean in what aspect of human behavior? They are better business savvy people than the greatest scientists who are brilliant. There was a study at Harvard 35 years ago or so. They measured the Baker Scholars, so the top 5%. But most CEOs came from the middle of the class. They had the people savvy. They were brilliant about people. But the people in the 5% of the class as Baker Scholar were not brilliant about people. So we define that brilliance in what aspects? A brilliant tennis player is not a brilliant baseball player. So we define that. So one day, I was working with the chairman of DuPont in the 90s. Tall, lean fellow, very courteous, southerner. So he had a habit to go to Starbucks and get some coffee, took me with him. And as a chairman, you know, people want to defer to him. He will say, no, I'm going to stay in line, because he and I kept talking. So as we came close to receiving the coffee, he motioned me towards where the food was displayed. He said, what do you see? And I couldn't see anything. Then he says, here is the brand of Starbucks. They charge higher price. But look at how badly the food is displayed. That's observation. I had the chance to write a book, Game Changer, with the former CEO of Procter & Gamble, A.G. Leff. And he used to go every weekend to supermarket, visit them. He's the one who found that electric toothbrush, and he bought it for $3 million. And if he's going to do, other people have to go. They have no choice. And say, what do you observe? What's new? What's behavior? Indra Nooyi did that every weekend in Pepsi. So the CEOs know they're busy as hell. They have to do too many things. But to know the business, to know the consumer, not just the market research reports, you got to know the consumer.
So that customer intimacy is really important. You also mentioned, Ram, that we see our organizations from an inside-out perspective, but need an outside-in view. So how can the best leaders do that? A lot of leaders of organizations feel like they have a good understanding of what their customers' needs are. How do you guide them to have an outside-in view of their organization?
In the early days, in Unilever, P&G, Colgate, in these companies, every vice president was required to spend a week and live with the consumer. It's in my book, Game Changer. Observe it. Do that. Now, I have instituted in companies that if you really want to be consumer-centric, you must do three things. Number one, in your executive committee meeting, you must devote 10 minutes what's new about the consumer. Ask them to talk. No baloney, because you're going to require that every executive committee meeting, every committee meeting anywhere. How did I come with the idea? 1976, DuPont began to focus on safety. They required in every company they went in that every meeting starts with safety. Why can't we start every meeting with consumer? Any allocation of capital you do anywhere, insist the consumer data. I remember I was writing the book with A.G. Leffley, and he was mentioning somebody came to show him something and say, A.G., what do you think? And I never forget it. A.G. said, I'm not the customer. Go to the customer and find out. Create the culture of knowledge of the consumer.
So that is definitely one of the key elements that you keep mentioning. There has to be that deep understanding, some of it based on intuition, some of it based on data, artificial intelligence, machine learning. You also mentioned, Ram, that companies don't die. Leaders-led companies die. And whether Barnes & Noble or Nokia, you had a couple of really unique experiences and understanding of how hubris can bring organizations down.
Oh, no doubt. You see, the boards fail in those situations. You see, Ford came to its nadir in 2007. How could that be? It was healthy balance sheet equation 1996. So in a period of 11 years, what happened? You can blame everybody. So you don't need a doctoral thesis. If you have three consecutive wrong CEOs and the company survives, it's because the brand refuses to die. So at one point in 96, former chairman of DuPont became a director of Apple. Now I've worked with him for years. So he and I talked all the time. And he says, Ron, Apple brand refuses to die. Company should not die. So it's in my book, Boards That Lead, first chapter, how he brought single-handedly Steve Jobs back. With the board's approval, he tried to sell the company. There were no buyers. Eventually brought Steve Jobs back single-handedly. Look what one man did. And then his succession, look at Tim Cook. He brought Tim Cook. He was a low-level supply chain guy in a 3% net margin business called Compaq. So leaders and the boards are accountable for success or failure. Now look at the AT&T today. They're divesting to a different one. What was the board doing? Where were they? They should ask, how much question did they ask in approving the deal? Did they spend 2, 3, 4 days to understand the deal? Did they understand what talent was required to play the new game? By putting this totally new game in the old game, what will happen to the speed of decision-making? These are great board people. I know some of them. But why did they not spend 3 days full-time looking at it? Chances are they did not. I don't know that. By the way, AT&T made mistake twice. They should look at which board members are common. One time they bought Hughes system. That had to be divested. So it's not one mistake. There are two consecutive mistakes. They are not the normal errors. They are the errors of not spending due diligence on the board part. They just carried what the CEO wants.
For anyone that doubts that organizations can turn around and do well, and my audience is very familiar because I'm a huge Satya Nadella fan of what he's done with Microsoft. But you also mention Walmart and Mary Barra leading at GM as great examples of organizations that have truly taken on this need for transformation and rethinking their competitive advantage.
In the case of Walmart, it's facts. It's not a matter of my judgment. Doug McMillon comes in and he has the wisdom to buy a company that can digitize. And the CEO, Laurie, had actually worked for Amazon, sold his company to him in Amazon. So he's able to put the basic AI in the company properly. Even though Walmart had the digitization of 2001, but did not do much with it. And as a result, he's now connected consumer, last mile delivery, and converting these stores as a competitive advantage, as a place to pick up. Now they're using the Amazon approach. That is the customer. What is the total living needs of the consumer? Healthcare, advertising. So they begin to move on that. They got the digital engine. So it's on the way. Stock price has doubled. I'm very hopeful it's going to go far in the future. And so that's about the Walmart. I was very lucky. I was in a CEO summit where they had a Harvard-type amphitheater. And Mary came and just sat next quite me all day. It was a great honor to do. I didn't disturb her. I had a great respect. Now, remember, one of the key things in automobile business is product. No product, no automobile company. And it requires a several years ahead planning. And you got to allocate the right resources and not sprinkle the desert with a teaspoon. You have limited resources. She came from product. And then she came from human resources. She is a superb business savvy lady. And I want to give you an example of inclusion. It's coming in my book, co-authored, called TSR, Talent Strategy and Risk for Boards. She keeps the board informed with a 2-page memo almost every week, seeks their advice. She is coming in my book. The activist shareholders went to them. She listens to them. She picked up one good idea. That's leadership. She is gaining. The stock price is moving. I like her plan. She may not be number one in 10 years, but she will be in the top three. I have no doubt. She will not be there as a CEO in 10 years. Not likely. I'm pretty sure she will have a succession. She believes in it. I don't work for her, but I watch her. We have leaders in America who can do that, but get the right leaders and don't get away with degrees and with pedigree. And she's not a person you're going to see as a flamboyant. She's not a flamboyant. You don't hear her all over the network. We have people in automobile industry all over the network publicizing themselves. didn't do a damn thing. You know the names. You don't hear Mary Barra publicizing enough. She's focused on the job.
And as you showed in that example, she's obviously open to feedback, which, Ram, you mentioned in the book, feedback is critical to leadership. One of the challenges that I see with a lot of leaders is that the higher up they move in the organization, partly they become more closed off to feedback, and partly people gauge the feedback they provide to them. So how do you guide executives to truly be open to and embrace feedback as they look to lead more effectively?
It's a great question, but I want to tell you a more damning thing. The mold of the people who have come through in most companies is competing among themselves through bureaucracy, through presentations, through building internal coalitions, doing incremental things, finding a way to get their budget approved. They're not going to succeed. It's a game of speed. It's a game of entrepreneurship. It's a game of major change. It's a game of knowing the consumer. It's knowing getting the competitors who don't come from your industry. So in my work of succession, I'm telling the boards and the CEOs, look at the third and fourth layer. Create new paths for them to succeed in 7 years. They have energy. They think differently. There are millennials coming up there. They understand how to create businesses. Now, coming back to the listening part of it, go and listen to the customer. Get other people to listen to the customer. If you do that, you'll be easier to listen to others. I had the honor of working John Reed, Citigroup chairman, CEO in the 90s, and I conducted a program for him, month-long program for his high potentials. So he told me a rule. He said, you tell the group, they were given assignments to present. If they know I know something and they present, don't come. So I supervise those teams. I said, he knows that, don't produce that. He'll be courteous, he'll throw you out. I guarantee he'll be courteous. And you know what the students did? They loved it. You know, most of them are CEOs somewhere today. One of them is the head of S&P Global. So you as a leader set the tone and said, look, I am looking for diverse viewpoints. I had a CEO, his name is Dick Harrington, that became Thomson Reuters. And he had this thing in his view. He said, listen, I want to hear a diverse viewpoint, otherwise don't come. And that gave the license to question the CEO. Now you got to be respectful, you got to be courteous. It's a proven phenomenon of the lives of the people I'm allowed to see. I've worked with people who are nobodies. You see, I've been 50 years in this business, and they became CEOs, and I've coached more of them to become CEOs. These people had that curiosity to actively search opposite viewpoint. It's more so at the top level, because Walter Wriston used to tell Jack Welch, he said, Jack, you will be the last one to know. Think about that. You should be the first one to know. But we cannot change people's basic cognition, its personality. Remember, Satya Nadella did one thing great, I thought, among others. In the culture of Microsoft, it was, we know it all. He turned it, learn it all. That's why he succeeds. His stock price is now 7 times up, 8 times more likely. It's the same Microsoft, different leader, different content, different focus. As you know, Bill Gates is no longer on the board.
And Nadella truly serving as an example, not just talking about it, serving as an example of that learn it all. You also mentioned you spent a lot of time and wrote a book on Amazon. One of the things you mentioned is they have a weekly report with 62 pages of metrics. And those are really important in determining and understanding customers. While on the other side, Wells Fargo is a famous example of an organization that got in trouble because of focusing on the wrong metrics. So what are the metrics that you believe organizations and leaders should focus in on as they look to guide their organizations to become more competitive in rethinking competitive advantage?
In the case of Amazon, it's totally digitized. 62 pages is just about everything that gets measured. Since it's digital, you design it once. The deviations are found by the algorithms, anomaly trackers. So you tell what you want, engine will give you what they are, and then management will focus. So that's very comprehensive. Betty Galotti, she's the CHRO, came from a division, has 600 engineers with her. They're going to have zillion people inside. They're going to be assigned. She's making them, doing that. In the case of Wells Fargo, it's not the metrics. It's the CEO. When he was very young, I knew him. His incentive to do all those things, driving larger number of products per customer, it's the leadership, it's the incentives, it's causing lack of integrity in people. They knew it. These things are not hidden. No metrics would have prevented that. It's not Wells Fargo. It is the CEO and CFO.
And that leadership makes a big difference in that organizations need metrics, Ram. And to your point, it's the leadership that guided the organization in the wrong direction in measuring and pushing the wrong metrics.
Absolutely. We keep reinventing things. We're saying, no, integrity, you can't measure with metrics. The chief marketing officer would have known this. If he didn't, he was incompetent.
Well, Ram Charan, as I mentioned early on in the conversation, I can speak with you for hours and days because you have put out such great content, great thinking. And as I mentioned to you earlier, for me, you have been a wonderful teacher, which is why I call you, even though you were a professor, I keep calling you Professor Charan because you have had a great influence on my own thinking as a teacher. As I have read your books, even though you were a professor, you are not professorial. You are a practitioner and you take concepts and help others put them into practice, which is why I truly appreciate your business writing and your business insights, Professor Ram Charan.
Thank you. Mahan, I want to mention one thing. The most issue today, dealing with inequality. We change this, the GDP will increase. It will give dignity to people from check to check. That creates energy in people to do new things. We got to deal with that.
Professor Charan, it is absolutely critical. It is something that is close to my own heart, and I've dedicated some time and effort to it. I also serve as chairman of the board of Leadership Greater Washington, which is a regional group of business, government, and nonprofit leaders in the Greater Washington, D.C. DMV region. And that is absolutely critical for us because we truly believe to be able to take advantage of the opportunities ahead of us, to be able to do what you talk about and rethink competitive advantage, we have to break through some of these challenges with respect to inequality and provide greater opportunity to different people within our communities for greater growth for everyone. So I look forward to having more of that conversation with you and learning from your insights on how we as a community can tackle that inequality.
Thank you very much, Mahan.
You've been listening to Partnering Leadership with your host, Mahan Tavakoli. For additional leadership insights and bonus content, visit us at partneringleadership.com.